Chris Draper has won world championship titles and Olympic medal in the 49er skiff, and then he moved on to become one of the most in-demand helmsmen and wing trimmers in the modern era of the America's Cup, and more recently in SailGP. And he's also great at boat handling. He has to be, right? So that's why Chris Draper is the perfect guest for this session. It's all about Chapter 3 of Road to God. But firstly, some introductions. Hi, my name's Andy Rice. I'm in the UK. And Hamish, what have you been up to?
Yeah, well, just more or less a week of wing sailing. We've had strong easterlies every day. We're on our boat. We're tucked in to a harbour in Coromandel. I can have a little squizzy around the bay. And we're in an ideal place just to jump off the back of the boat and have a sail. So I'm really suffering physically this morning. Bit of whiplash from yesterday. And very, very sore arms that seem to want to go to sleep on me when I go to sleep. But I'm so happy to have Chris with us. So he'll be able to give me a few pointers, I'm sure.
Well, welcome, Chris. And I know how envious you're going to be of Hamish out there on his boat, because you have done quite a bit of boat life in your time, taking the family cruising for a huge length of time after, I think it was the 2017 America's Cup in Bermuda. So we might get into a little bit of that as well. But Chris, great to have you along. And tell us, what have you been up to so far this year, and where are you off to tomorrow?
Well, today I was winging as well, but I had a 6.5 hooded wetsuit on and it was about 4 or 5 degrees, so probably a bit different to Hamish's experience. I've been really busy start to the season. I've started doing quite a bit of coaching over more recent times, and with the Olympic sailors, they tend to want to do that in the winter. So, and then my sailing gets very busy during the summer. So it's it means that this period has been really quite hectic. I'm off to Miami tomorrow. I came back from Lanzarote last week and then go straight to Lanzarote when I get back from Miami. But it's great to be busy and working with some really fun teams, and I'm very lucky to continue doing SailGP with the Japanese, and really big event coming up for us in San Francisco with the final race for the overall season. And then the M32s with Inga from Sweden, which is a really nice circuit and a lovely team.
So we got a lot to dig into, and you've just mentioned San Francisco, and I also see that image. It looks like Luna Rossa over your right-hand shoulder on the wall behind you. And that makes me think of that Prada advert. And not only did your face appear in the Prada advert, but you were the voice on the Prada advert. You were selling aftershave or perfume or something. How did that come about?
That was a pretty out there experience. So they flew us, a bunch of us, to LA, and we spent about 10 days making this advert for Prada. And it was filmed by the guy that filmed the sequence in the Matrix movie where they're dodging all the bullets and things like that. So it cost a fortune. But we had makeup artists. It was hilarious. And actually, the only thing that they did use, Andy, was my head, because the rest of my features were not strong enough or significant enough to be actually in the movie. But yeah, it was good fun. And I was haunted by that voiceover for a long time. Yeah, that was filmed in a dingy container with a bunch of guys say, oh yeah, that's sexy. It was quite a strange experience, but it's all good. It was but it did haunt me for quite a while, that Prada advert.
Well, any of you eager Road to Goldsters out there care to go off into YouTube and dig out the link to that, please do drop it into the chat, and we can all remind ourselves of Chris's alternative profession, and one that maybe you'll go back to one day when you're too old for this sailing malarkey, Chris. But anyway, enough of perfume and aftershave. We're here to ask you about boat handling, and we'll see what else we get into as well. And Hamish was having a little bit of a dig at you just then about some strange jibing technique. So Hamish, just pick up on that story for us.
Oh yeah. You know, so I was coaching Chris some time ago, and was, I must say, a very enjoyable experience, Chris. But yeah, I'm thinking there was something about the jibing downwind of spinnaker, and I remember showing him the way I was doing it, and I think he might have been the only guy in the world to ever adopt that style. My memory's a little hazy though, so Chris, you'll have to remind me.
Yeah. Is I mean, yeah, it was. I think it was 98, 99, and 2000. They were really lucky to get a lot of coaching support from Hamish when he worked with the British 470s. And prior to my 49er sailing, I did some time in the 470. And yeah, I do remember that I had a bit of a funky jiving technique. I think there was a lot of my 470 sailing that was pretty funky, but a lot of skills that were taken from that boat into the 49er, you know, and all that time spent with you and racing against that fleet that, you know, when I went into the 49er and started racing that class, it became very quickly apparent that to apply some of that tactical knowledge that we had, we really need to focus a lot on our boat handling so that we could do that extra tack or do that extra couple of tacks, not hit that ley line quite as early and be confident that we could stick that tack that we needed to or perform that jibe set when it was breezy to get into that. And all of that, I think, came from the backbone of the 470 sailing and the time spent with you guys in that class and then being able to apply that through really good boat handling in the 49er.
Well, Hamish, that was something that you and Dave Barnes were well known for in the 470. You took the boat handling on to another level. So what convinced you that the boat handling needed to step up from where it was already? And what was your approach to it?
Yeah, I mean, boat handling to me is definitely the beginning of the pathway. You know, there's no point in going supersonic speeds if you can't turn on the corners, you know, and it becomes pretty apparent when you get on the racetrack that if your boat handling's lacking, you know, you're dropping, you're just bleeding points all over the table. And, you know, I think Chris alluded to not only just through boat handling errors, but just simply the ability to be able to go when you want to go somewhere, you know, you have the confidence to be able to do that extra jibe or that extra tack to get you into a really strong position. You know, I think one of the things that I would say about Chris is in the 49er was that your boat handling was pretty damn sharp. And I'm pretty sure you'd look back and realize that you had, there was points there on the table that you took that others didn't.
Yeah. What would you reckon, Chris? I mean, I remember I was sailing the 49er a similar time to you and I'd already been in the class for a bit and you came in. And one of the things I think you did was you did a lot of onshore drills, just running around the boat with the boat tied down to some anchor points in the boat park with the boom in the right place and just getting your hand and your foot movements right. So just tell us about the value of that process early on in your 49er career.
Yeah, you're right, Andy. That was very early days and we were really lucky in the UK in that there were a lot of people exceptionally good at 49er sailing, yourself and you know, there was like a squad of sort of five or six boats and there was a lot of knowledge there that we could sort of pull in on. And we spent a lot of time in those early days when the new guys were coming into the boat, looking at how we could get better at the boat handling, spent a lot of time watching videos of all of these guys perform maneuvers. It's like, okay, how do you do that? How do you physically get across the boat? How can I get across the boat quicker? How can I get across the boat quicker than anybody else in the fleet? And be able to do that in the heat of the moment. And that was the goal. And that was about, and spent a lot of time working through how many footsteps I could get across the boat in. What was the most efficient way to do it? You know, you might be able to do it in three, maybe four steps, but maybe it's better to take five and keep your balance kind of thing. And so we spent a lot of time doing that with video taken behind the boat and then tried to look at that when we're actually sailing in the early days and see whether you're actually replicating it and then be able to come back through bad manoeuvres and see whether that was what you'd actually done in practice or whether when you'd had a bad manoeuvre you had actually made a mistake in your footwork or something like that.
Okay, and would you recommend that shore-based kind of drill early on, particularly for skiff type of boats like the 49er?
Yeah, most definitely. I think in any dinghies it's valuable if it's achievable. You know, something like a moth, it's obviously much harder to tie it down cleverly and not damage your boat. So we had a couple of what we were effectively boat park training boats that were we actually had, you know, we have written off 49 from the insurance company that we used a lot. But I think if you can get something like that, you know, even like a 420, a 29er, if you're learning to crew a 29er, I can't think of a better drill than practicing going around the front of the mast when it's light winds, crossing as quickly as you can, wire to wire. And, you know, someone like Hamish was always known for his ability wire to wire tacking in a 470. And, you know, I think of Simon Hiscox that I sailed with, you know, the guy was a weapon across the boat, and especially it really shone through when it was about going in front of the mast. And that came through hours on the water, obviously. And I'm sure we'll touch on that in a minute, but a lot of drills on the shore as well.
Yeah. And Hamish, you talk about the doing your boat handling training early in a session, that you, if you're going to do a number of things in a session on the water, that you do your boat handling early. That's one of the things you go into in chapter 3 of Road to Gold. Just tell us about the thinking behind that.
Yeah, and I think keeping it short, you know, we, it's been like that for me on the, you know, the whole learning curve on the wing, on the wing foil, is just, you know, going, doing a little bit each day, you know, just a little bit. And just if you bracket some time, then your energy in that time becomes so much greater. Your energy and your focus and your concentration becomes so much greater. But if you haven't bracketed a certain amount of time, then it's really easy to just try to pace yourself a bit more physically and mentally, and you're not really putting 100% in. So, you know, I really strongly recommend that you, whatever your day looks like, you get your boat handling in first when you're freshest, bracket the time. So you might say, I'm going to do this for 15 minutes. It might be some figure of eights if you're in a skiff, or it might be whatever. But you do it for a certain amount of time, knowing that you're going to leave everything on the table and not hold back. And if you do a little bit each time, it's amazing the progression. It's no point in banging head against the wall for hours and hours, because you're just going to learn bad habits typically, and you're just going to be pacing yourself and not really doing at a race pace.
So Chris, tell us your view on that. I seem to remember there was something that you and Simon Hiscox used to do called the golden hour or something like that. There was some sort of specific routine you went through.
Yeah, we did. I mean, generally our training model would run something like, we'd do a 6 or 7 day training camp abroad, and then we would come home for a week or 7 or 8 days. And then during that week, we would focus on just our standard hour, which we would try and do 4 or 5 days of that week. So we'd take a couple of days off, then train for 4 or 5 days, and then a day off, and then travel to the next training camp. So that standard hour was like our constant reference that we would always, even if we were spending the day working on the equipment, you know, we'd still make sure we got on the water to go and do that standard hour of boat handling. And it, with the 49er, you know, like Hamish alluded to there, it was very, you know, fast manoeuvring orientated. It basically involved, you know, a downwind and an upwind, 5 tacks, 4 jibes, and then straight into a 5-lap race course, pretty much as short as we could manage with progressively harder manoeuvres as we went through it. Then we'd do about 10 minutes of low speed sailing with a couple of trigger pulls, but really focusing on just trying to sail as slowly and as close to the breeze as we could. Then back into another 5-lapper or a gut buster or something like that. And then more focused specific starting exercises. And then we would finish with what was like our area of focus according to that wind speed. So, you know, we spent a lot of time performance profiling, which I see is a very similar model to what Road to Gold runs, where, you know, we'd assess all our maneuvers across every wind speed, every maneuver that we have to perform on the water for every race day, or at any point around the race course. And then, so we could identify, let's say it's 18 knots, we're in Weymouth, we're doing our standard hour, 18 knots of breeze, the biggest maneuver that we need to practice is a jibe round up or something like that. And that would be the exercise that we'd go and do then for 15 minutes to finish the session. So that after we came in, even though it was just a standard hour to not necessarily improving, but certainly maintenance, but hopefully improving through repetition, there was definitely one area that we could come in and say, we've working on the progression point of moving that area onwards.
And how much is enough? And how do you know when to stop? Because you could be perfecting and honing your boat handling forever and ever. So how do you decide when enough is enough?
Well, the way that we've always done it is, you know, I think it was discussing it just before we came on the call, you know, I thought someone and I had come up with this process ourselves, but looking through the Road for Gold stuff, I think it was actually Hamish that taught me a long time ago. But we, like I say, we performance profiled everything. And the way that we rated it was, if we wanted to win the major championship or achieve our goal for that year, then we felt that we, if it was a key focus event, we needed to score 9 out of 10 in as many areas as we possibly could. 9 out of 10 meant that we felt we were world leaders in that area or very close to. So we would grade everything. You know, it was about a 40-item list. Tacking would be broken down into, you know, flat water, chop and waves, high wind speed, light, medium and heavy. And then I would grade it and Simon would grade it. And then we put it together. And then from there, they would go down through every aspect of boat handling. It would then go into racing skills, our equipment, sponsorship, all aspects of the campaign, but particularly focusing on boat handling now. We then use that to break it down into what part of that manoeuvre is it that we need to work on. Okay, so let's say we both scored jibe set in over 17 knots as only 6 out of 10. What is it about the jibe set that we're doing that's wrong? So, and then we'd start to break that down into the maneuver. Okay, is it that we're jibing before the halyard's hitting the right point, or is it that we're doing a bad bailway into the jibe, and start to work through it and break it down into processes, and then focus on improving those processes. And we would use our standard hour to do that. So I guess the short answer, Andy, to your question is, when we felt that we were at a high enough level to achieve our goal, that was when we were satisfied that we'd worked on the boat handling enough. So I'd suggest it's probably pretty hard to ever be too good at boat handling, because, you know, the bar can always be raised on what can be achieved. And, you know, you see with the America's Cup and things like that these days, and 49er sailing, you know, we thought we were bloody good at it, but now you look at them and they're sailing around with bare feet and they look like they're out to lunch and they're doing all the manoeuvres that we used to do and being hanging on by the skin of our teeth. So I think you can never really be good enough, but the only way to improve in my mind is to assess where you're at and look at how and what you can do to develop.
And Hamish, obviously, Pete Burling and Blair Tuke's boat handling has always been exceptional in the 49er. They were already the best at boat handling in 2016. I mean, maybe they were close to one of the best in 2012, winning that silver medal as well. Maybe they were the best there. But what motivated them to keep on working at the boat handling when they're already top of the pile?
Yeah, I think it just comes back to those points that are available when your boat handling's good. And anyone that's watched Peter and Blair in the 49er, and I know there's a lot of people out there who have, you'll see them do something extraordinary in every day. You know, there's a moment of the three-race day sometime where they'll do something boat handling-wise that's extraordinary, that hasn't been done before, and it leaves your jaw, you know, hitting the coach pope deck, you know. And I think, you know, that's what I think the variety that you throw at it, you know, analysing for sure the exact moves you want to try to achieve, and then really the creativity to extend beyond that, like there is no ceiling. When you're in practice, particularly on those short courses, it's amazing, you know, just doing something completely different, hasn't been done before, and they'll just come in buzzing, you know, like, wow, did you see that, Hamish? Yeah, I saw that. So it's I think it's just, you know, right, what Chris said, absolutely, you know, drilling in and getting more and more perfection in the manoeuvres, you know, but then being creative enough to think of some new ones as well.
Yeah, I remember seeing a double jibe by Burling and Tuke in one of the European Championships in Denmark, probably getting on for 8 or 9 years ago. going straight into a jibe set. But no, as soon as they completed the jibe on that one, they jibe back onto starboard, and now they've gained depth advantage on everybody that's hoisted ahead of them. Just an incredible manoeuvre. Chris, I seem to remember that you and Simon once discovered that there was a chink in your armoury, and you realised that you didn't actually know how to do a windy port hand bear away. But have I got that story right?
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, I think, and that's a, it's a good point, you know. And something else, I've just seen that Richard Parsley, who he did a bit of work with us, lots of work with us in the 49ers. He did get us to do a lot of 720s and 360s, and also then get us to do them in reverse to make sure that we could do it all each way. And like you say, Andy, yeah, we were pants at bearing away on port for a little while. And then realise that, you know, you've just got to be able to bear away on every on both tacks, so you can manoeuvre in the pre-start, obviously, as well as possible. But I can't get over enough how much repetition, and I think what Hamish just touched on there, that there is no ceiling to how good you can boat handling, and to keep seeing it from that point of view.
And good to get some questions and comments in. We'll come out onto those in a moment. And Richard, if you want to join us, it'd be great to get you in on the call. So Richard, just if you can come in, let's hear more about that 720 and 360 practice.
Can you hear me?
Yes, hear you, Richard.
Yeah, well, the thing is, if you're in a position where you've got to do a 360 or a 720, it's already a problem. And if you get it wrong, it's going to be a disaster. I mean, we've all seen people going for a 720 or a 360 and a 49er and capsizing. And so it's one of those things where you're already a little bit upset. And sometimes you're thinking, oh, should I do it? Was I in the right in that situation? All that's going through your head. And if you decide you're going to do your turns, you've got to do it really quickly and just get on with the rest of your race. And there's an interesting thing in the 49er as well. Like normally in most boats, you'd say, I'm going to start my circles. If I'm going upwind, I'm going to start with a tack. And if I'm going downwind, I'm going to start with a jibe drop. And actually, remind me to say at the end about the jibe drop that Chris and Simon did at the Europeans once, that was pretty good. But in the 49er, if you're going upwind and it's borderline, if it's really windy, you do not want to start with a tack to do your 360, because you'll probably capsize bearing away from a stationary position. So there's another decision you've got to make. Right, okay, well, I'm going up when I'm not so sure about doing the tack bear away. Let's start with the bear away. And that obviously requires communication between the helm and the crew. And the more times you've done it, you know, the repetition, especially when it's really windy and borderline, then the more likely it is that you're going to minimize your losses if you ever have to do it in a championship. And that's what it's all about, you know, minimizing your losses from something bad that's happened.
Richard, thank you very much for that. Great to have you on the call.
The jibe drop for Chris and Simon.
Go on.
It was in the finals of the, I can't remember where it was. Was it Aarhus, Simon, Doug, Chris?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, well, the lads, they used to decide they were going to push it at the windward mark every now and then and try and nibble in on port and tack, and got away with it once in every maybe 20. And they decided they were going to do it in the finals of this last thing, right under Ica. Obviously, you're not going to do that because he's not going to let you go. So off they go, and they're still not doing their turn. At this point, the umpire decides he's going to ping them. Now, instead of just doing a tack when you're going downwind, you've got to do the full 360. And Chris and Simon did such a fast jibe, drop and tack that it was all like they, I don't think they even lost a position on that downwind leg, but they still had to do another jibe. So, the umpire's sort of trickling along like that, and I'm sort of watching, just sweating. And then eventually they go, oh, yeah, we've got a jibe. But their initial jibe, drop and tack was so fast that it almost lost nothing. You know, Simon would get the spinnaker down probably two-thirds of the way, because then it's less to hoist when you finished, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'd love to take some credit, but I'm sure it was pretty much all Simon's handiwork.
Rich, thanks very much for that. Great to have you on the call.
Okay, no worries.
Multiple champion in a bunch of different classes in his own right. Robert, you've got a question for Chris about how much time to devote in a short training session. So let's get you in. And just while we do, big hands up to Sarah Jane for digging out the YouTube video. I haven't had a chance to see Chris Draper or Jake Gyllenhaal. It's hard to tell which is which, isn't it? So I don't know if you've got the right one out of YouTube, but anyway, well done for that. Let's see if Robert's there. No, maybe not. So let's ask that question for Robert. So Chris, on a 2-hour boat training session, how much would you devote to boat handling?
I think I would say, Andy, that it very much comes down to how much time you spend in the class. You know, if you're new to that class and you're have everything to learn and you can, let's take a moth, for example. If you cannot jibe or you cannot tack, then I would spend my whole 2 hours trying to do one of those two things. And I probably wouldn't waste much of the rest of the time trying to go as quick as I could or any other stuff. But obviously there's going to be a balance, because if you just keep sploshing all the time, then you're going to get pretty exhausted. But you know, whatever boat it is, whether I think if you're new to it, I would put much more emphasis on the boat handling. If you've spent a lot of time in it and you're refining, then I think you would consider reducing the amount of time that you spend on the boat handling. I think a lot of it comes down to just being really honest with yourself as to what your strengths and your weaknesses are, and which is your best bang for buck. And often, you know, it is actually doing the boat handling, which isn't as fun as trying to go really fast in a straight line.
That's a great answer. And Hamish, it makes me think of the whole sequential learning and the prioritization embedded within the order that you've put Road to Gold together. So this question of how much to devote to any one thing, just tell us why you put the chapters in the order that you did.
Yeah, well, that sequential learning is definitely relevant arriving in a new class and even just starting the whole thing, you know, like which class to choose and, you know, who to choose to support you. So, yeah, there's a lot of logic in that. And as Chris said too, you know, you will often see people changing classes or progressing through into other classes. And, you know, that requires a real self-analysis, a real performance analysis of where you are, where you need to devote your time. So certainly what's Road to Gold's all about is comparing yourself to the best you know, the best in fleet.
Just gone a bit broken there, Hamish. Now, I'm going to pick up on what Hamish was saying there, and it actually relates to one of our early questions from a Road to Goldster who refers themselves only as iPad. iPad, if you want to come in and ask your question, that would be great. It's about data and technology.
There we go.
Oh, you're back.
Yes, sorry about that. We're back.
Yeah, no. Let's get into this question, because you just, Hamish, you just touched on analysing where you're at. And one of our early questions, I think we might have iPad here. So iPad, come in and ask your question.
Hi, guys. Yeah, it's me. It's Mike Madge.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Chris. I got a question for you. Like, especially on boats like 49ers, fast sailing cats, like tacking, it seems like, you know, it's almost a feel thing where, you know, every tack, there's a little bit difference in terms of the main sheet you release, how quickly you get to the other side. So I'm wondering, like, when you're coaching it are you like videoing and relying a lot on data, like how fast they're coming out of the tack, what their tacking angles are? Or are you doing more talking with the guys and asking, like, how did that tack feel? Because without that, is it more just relying on feel? How does that tack feel?
Yeah, I think, you know, the straight answer to your question is that I'm definitely using data a lot more recently in the coaching that I've been doing. You know, there's lots of little devices out there that very easy to record what your boat speed is when you're training. Obviously, most classes don't allow it when you're racing, but it can be a huge asset for when you are assessing yours, particularly if you're sailing on your own, where, you know, it's very easy to look at what your bottom speed is, for example, from a tack, or your bottom speed from a jibe versus your entry speed. And you know, very quickly, your tack loss can become quite easy to analyze. You know, you're sailing along at a general boat speed of 9 knots and you drop to 6 knots, and then you look back through it and that was a bad tack. But if you're only dropping 7, 7.5 knots, then you can start to think about it. Or if you've got some video, then you can also apply that and look at what it was that you did differently. If you've got a second boat there or multiple boats, then it's obviously a lot easier to assess what your performance was relative to them and gauge whether or not it was a good or a bad maneuver that way. But I definitely think that it's becoming more and more feasible for everyday sailing to be able to apply that. It's undoubtedly easy to get wrapped up in the numbers, but I do think it can be an asset in modern sailing these days.
Any follow-up on that, Mike? Any further questions?
No, thank you. That was really good. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate that.
Thanks, yeah. Mike.
I think, Mike, even, you know, sorry, Andy, just to touch on that again, you know, a lot of people these days have a Garmin watch, you know, and you can start a piece of software, like just something like Race Countdown or something like that. And it gives you a track of your speed and you can very easily go back through it and very, very easily see a bar graph that shows you your speeds, how much you lost when you tacked. And it's very easy to identify your maneuvers on it. Even something like a Garmin, I think, can give you useful information, especially if you can then have a video camera that's on your boat somewhere that you can then apply that to as well. I think it's very easy to achieve these days.
Chris, you've worked in the America's Cup and more recently in Sail GP. And obviously there's a huge opportunity for data analysis in Sail GP. I don't think you can really keep any secrets within that world, right? So just tell us about the rate of learning in an America's Cup where you're keeping secrets compared with Sail GP, where you're sort of forced into operating like a squad in a way, even though you're deadly rivals.
It's a blooming good question, Andy. And I think it's very easy for the fleet to morph. And what happens is you start to see in the Sail GP, you start to see someone perform very well in a certain condition. And what tends to happen is the fleet slowly morphs into the same settings as that other team. And I think, you know, in the last event in Sydney, probably learned more in a week than I have in, you know, the last 3 or 4, maybe even longer years. By working with Glenn Ashby, and he, you know, he came in with a very, very different and open book of how to do things. And, you know, I'd been, I guess, slowly refining and slowly developing my knowledge base about trimming wings. But he came in and helped us in that Sydney event. And I really learned an enormous amount. And I guess it was a massive reminder of how broad this sport is. And how easy it is to become very complacent that you think you know everything about the sport, or not everything, but you know a lot about what your job is and what you do. And he just absolutely sort of blew my mind and the rest of the teams, I think, on how much better we could sail the boat. And I think, like, it's very easy with the data, seeing everybody's data, to see somebody performing well, start to look at their settings and start to just apply them rather than think about the theory of why. And I think that was the biggest thing that I learned more recently, that you've got to back up what you're doing with the theory to understand what it's actually achieving for you. And that has been a massive learner for me over the last sort of couple of months.
Well, we're due to get Glenn Ashby on one of these calls in the coming weeks. So, Chris, it'd be great if you can join us for that one as well. But what question should we be asking Glenn? Why has he been in such big demand in the America's Cup for the last 15 years or so?
Yeah, I think a lot of what I a bit of what I touched on there, Andy, from just, you know, obviously, don't get me wrong, we get incredible coach support with SailGP Japan. We work with Joe Glanfield, who I think's done one of these calls with you guys before. And, you know, Joe, what Joe brings to our campaign is quite different to Glenn in many ways. Joe brings enormous building of the team and things like that. Glenn's skills are very much about, he's obviously just spent a lot of time sitting next to designers and understanding the theory of everything that he puts into practice. And I think, you know, Mike touched on that question about data and how you use that. And, you know, but I think, you know, someone like Glenn is thinking more about, okay, I'm tacking, what's happening to the center of mass in the boat and how does it continue after the maneuver and how can I use that to apply to the maneuver and make the maneuver better or something like that, for example. And I think it's that outside the box thinking that is, you know, I'm sure it's a massive part of what's been so huge with Pete and Blair's 49er sailing, but also with what Team New Zealand have been achieving for the last couple of America's Cup cycles.
Hamish, this isn't the Glenn Ashby show, but is there anything you want to follow up on that in terms of how you've worked with Glenn?
Well, I think, yeah, I agree with Chris. Glenn is one of the most creative guys I know, you know, and I think the way he thinks about things is just completely different. And I think what Chris alluded to there was that it's all too easy with the data we have to sort of just fall back on that as the sort of the default means of moving forward. And what tends to happen is you're really only reacting to other people's improvements. And what, you know, what Glenn can bring to the table is that you can be that other person all the time. You can be the creator of these, you know, technical advances, whether they're in tuning or whether they're in the technique of how to sail the boat or how to maneuver the boat. And that comes from a real clear understanding of what's going on in terms of the physics and the dynamics and the and so on. So that's something that Glenn's incredibly strong at. It's his area.
Great. Thanks, Hamish. Chris, I'm interested in what, once you've been steeped in the world of SailGP and the America's Cup, what you can then take back to the simpler world of, say, Olympic sailing. So just tell us about the coaching that you're doing at Olympic level and what extra benefit you think you can bring to those teams in the Olympic scene because of that technical background in the Cup and SailGP.
Yeah, good question, Andy. I think I'd like to think it's quite broad. With some of the teams that I've worked with over the past few years, it's been a lot more kind of mentorship about their campaigns and giving an overall picture, helping to explore how they plan their program, what equipment they need when, what their focus area is at certain times and how they move forwards. And I guess part of that comes from Olympic campaigning in the past, but also from things like America's Cup, where you're literally working against ever decreasing timeline and a massive challenge on that front. And then I think, you know, you're on the development process all of the time, and the refinement of the equipment, the open mindedness with the equipment, the open mindedness of what can be achieved. And I think that gives me a nice opportunity to be able to bring that to different classes and also, you know, the technical side, the detail of the technical side and how we can apply data or how we can apply learning from that side of the sport into the normal simple classes that don't have all those sensors all over the boats and so on. And but how we could maybe apply some of that learning without necessarily having access to all of that really intense technology.
So you are a fan of what technology can do, but you've said don't get caught up in the numbers. So, for example, with the German NACRA 17 team, who ended up winning the bronze in Tokyo last year, what kind of technology are they using? And tell us about your involvement with that team and where data analysis comes in there, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I can't obviously give too much away about what the German Federation is doing and so on. But I think I'm really seeing a quite a change in Olympic coaching at the moment. And certainly I can tell you about what we do in SailGP and what we do in the M32s. And I can see how that's getting applied to Olympic sailing. And one of the big things that I've seen more recently is something called Nord Player, which was originally developed for the TP52s. And it's a piece of software that allows us to synchronize multiple video feeds and data feeds, and it produces a timeline that's very, very easy to access. So then it means that if I've got on footage, as well as some drone footage, as well as the footage of somebody's of the start, as well as a dictaphone recording or something like that, I can synchronize it all and then play it all back in the debrief. And it makes the debriefing process exceptionally easy, and also very, very structured. And that player is, you know, that's something that we had in the America's Cup. I first remember seeing it in a version called Race Cutter when I was working with Oracle. And it was a very impressive bit of kit. And this Nord Player one is one that's becoming much more widely available. And that's been helping a lot. So that's something that I'm definitely seeing changing in Olympic sailing and learning to drive that. And, you know, you kind of more of a, if when you're coaching now, I think it's you're kind of more expected to be able to do that than you have been in the past.
Yeah. So it's becoming a much more technical game. Maybe Hamish, you're just about going to manage to dodge that bullet. I know it's not your favourite thing. And you seem to have done pretty darn well without too much technology. But if you go around another cycle, are you going to have to tech up a little bit more, do you think?
Yeah, well, we were fortunate enough in that last cycle. We dragged somebody along for that job for drone and photography. And it was a really good, really good call to invest in that. And I think a lot of teams are doing that now. It's a bit, you can argue that it's a bit too much to ask the one person to be everything. And maybe it's a good idea to have a technical person in your support group who's just managing that side of things. Or it could be that I'm just too lazy and too old to take it on.
We got some good questions coming in. I'm going to go a little bit left field with Paolo's question. So we're going to sort of do a bit of an ad break from boat handling if Paolo wants to come and ask your question.
Hi, Chris. Hi. My question is not on the competitive aspect of sailing. It's about what gives you pleasure. So I have my moment repeating itself every time I hoist the main sail and I can turn off the engine. That's a magic moment when sailing happens. And so that's the magic moment I seek every time I go out on the boat. And I was wondering, you know, when you are in the performance world, you know, you kind of become, you know, addicted probably to adrenaline and to competition and everything. And I was wondering if you still have your moment of pleasure, something that you treasure and that gives you, you know, your thing.
Yeah, sure. No, it's a good question. I think very similarly to you, if I was on my cruising boat, then it's when the engine goes off and you're just sailing along off to somewhere. But I think the repeated thing that happens in sailing, I absolutely love it when you do a fantastic maneuver. I feel that there's nothing more rewarding. And I mean, particularly like the F50s, the boats we sail in SailGP, like when you execute a very good maneuver in that, the feeling of the synchronization, you know, there's like 40 button presses that have to be done in perfect timing of five people all orchestrating it all perfectly together. And it's exceptionally rewarding. And I think that it can happen, whether it's a tack, a jibe, a roundup tack or whatever. But that feeling and that sensation of that teamwork to make that maneuver happen, I think would be the thing that I would pinpoint.
Paolo, nice question. And Chris, well done for bringing it back to boat handling. But I just quickly want to ask you about the time that you spent cruising with the family. What did you do? What convinced you to do it? And what was it like?
It was something that my wife and I had always wanted to do. And when I stopped Olympic sailing in sort of 07, when we didn't qualify for Beijing. We wanted to go then, but we didn't have a penny to, we didn't have 2 6 to run together, you know. We put everything into Olympic sailing, so we weren't able to do it. And then after the America's Cup in Bermuda, we, you know, we'd given everything to the America's Cup for sort of 7 8 years, and my daughter had been born during the Cup, and I really hadn't spent much time with her, and my son was 7 or 8 years old by then, and we just wanted to go and spend some time together as a family. So yeah, we saved up some money during our time in Bermuda, and we bought ourselves a boat to and went cruising for 19 months. It was going to be for quite a lot longer, but I got the opportunity with SailGP, so we came home, and we still want to go back. We didn't manage to cross the Pacific. We spent the whole time going up and down the Caribbean. Then we went up and down those Windward Islands about 15 times. But it was great time. And yeah, incredible family time, and really, really enjoyable.
Oh, amazing. And I know you'll be back to it. Right, back to the serious stuff. We got a question from Jan Chu. And Jan, your question is for Hamish. Let's see if we can get you in to ask your question directly.
Hamish, I'd be interested to get your views on this, on the last cycle, I guess, with Pete and Blair, because it seemed like they did have some, you know, I guess, big mistakes at key moments at the Olympics in 2019, while falling out of the boats during maneuvers. But what's more interesting will be, I guess, finding out in your debriefs what you guys may have done differently in that last cycle, and the learnings going forward, I guess.
Yeah, thanks, Jan. Interesting question. Obviously, we've done a lot of soul searching. The first impression to me for Japan was that we were kind of a week short of time. You know, if we could have gotten another week in those conditions, in the lighter stuff, I feel like we were learning so much that we would have probably eliminated some of those mistakes. Like you talked about, falling out of the boat. And so it seemed to me that was really just came down to time. And when I look back on it from a distance that we are now, I still feel like, there was just time constraints in that program from the America's Cup through to the Tokyo Olympic Games to have done, you know, much more, much differently. And with COVID, you know, we were really restricted with, you know, MIQ. We had to do 2 weeks coming back to New Zealand. And, it was a real riddle to put together a program that was going to enable the boys to achieve their best in that short time span.
All right. Thanks for that.
Yep.
Thanks for that question, Jan. And thanks, Hamish. I'm trying to think what this quote was from one of our top table tennis players. He talked about execute with confidence and evaluate with humility. Chris, it's always interesting to me. You've got to have absolute confidence and a self-belief verging on arrogance. But at the same time, when you make a mistake, just like when Hamish was responding to Jan's question, you've got to find that space for humility to say, well, what could we have done better? So mentally, how do you have the arrogance to succeed and also the humility to analyze how you can be better?
I think that it's obviously it's hard to strike the balance between the two. I think the biggest thing is, I think different people have different strengths. And I think for some people, that confidence comes very naturally. And for others, that confidence can actually be quite hard to generate. While they might have the skills, they often don't generate that arrogance to make it happen, so to speak. I think something that I always found easier in sailing was to assess our weaknesses and be able to focus on what we needed to do to develop our weaknesses. And we always had it. You were talking about sayings there, Andy. We always had a saying that was pressure was for the unprepared, and that we felt if we went into any event and we had prepared as well as we possibly could, then there was no pressure to perform whatsoever, because we'd gone into it confident that we were at that level that we needed to be in every area. obviously there are times that that doesn't happen, and but I can very much remember back to events where that we went into 100% confident that we had everything that we needed to win that regatta. But there were also events that were very key that I remember we went into them and it's like, oh, we're struggling a little bit in the light right now and we can't really do much about it. I think that that constant assessment, like I say, of where you're at, what you can improve, what are your weak areas, and just total honesty with yourself is one of the biggest things that you can do to improve your performance in this sport that's so broad and varied. I see it a lot at the moment. My son's starting to sail Optimists, and I've been working with the local Optimist sailors at the local club, and it's very easy as an Optimist sailor to focus on the things that you're very good at. And, whenever it's light winds, you see a lot of them, they're just like down in the dumps. They're not interested. They just don't want to give it a shot. But as soon as the breeze picks up, they're first. And then they're just desperately crossing and hoping that the big event that they want to do well in is in those conditions. And I think, like you touched on, Andy, it's the maturity as you grow older and wiser to focus on what you need to improve, to give yourself that confidence and develop that inherent, what you described as arrogance, but I would say, confidence in your ability to perform when you want to.
Great. And talking of becoming an Optimist parent, you find yourself going up against Nick Rogers, who I think you beat in a 470 Olympic trial when you shouldn't have done once, right?
We were rivals through all of our Optimist days and things like that. And it's incredible to see. The first time I saw his son sailing an Optimist, I was on the committee boat at the local Optimist Open, and this kid came up and I was like, oh my gosh, that is Nick Rogers. And sure enough, it was Johnny, his lad. It's very cool to see. It's great to see it all going full circle.
Well, we've seen Hamish's kids go on to do pretty great things at the Olympics in two different sports. Chris, what's going to be your approach to being an Oppie parent, and how's it going so far? Have you got the high def binoculars already?
It's been varied. Yeah, I did get photographs taken of me with binoculars in hand. Actually, this weekend it's pretty bad, but it's been a real pleasure. My son has got into it with very little pushing, to be honest, and we really weren't sure if he was going to get into it, and suddenly this summer something clicked and he's really keen. So it's been fun, and it's been really fun to work with the local club and try. There's there's a bunch of kids there that are really keen, and it's good fun to help them.
I'm going to pick up on Pablo and his question. Pablo, you asked this a while back. Let's see if we can get you in to ask it. I think we've dealt with some of this, but you might want to follow up on some of the things here. Let's see if we can get you to ask the question. Camera is broken. Let me ask it. Sorry, I've just lost it here. So there's a couple of questions. I think we've dealt with them to an extent, but when going into a new class, what's the process you follow to learn the manoeuvres? Do you start with boat park onshore, then mechanisation of steps and automatisation of steps? Tell us, what do you do, Chris?
I think one of the biggest things I've done in the past with all of the classes that have been new to me that I've sailed is watched a lot of video. Especially if there's enjoyable video to watch. I remember, Andy, I'm sure you remember them, the Schneider series videos from the 49ers back in the day. I watched those and I'd pretty much worn the videotapes out. Videotapes back in that day. And similarly with the Moth, just heaps and heaps of footage of Nathan and all those guys sailing the Moth when I was learning to do that. And I think that's really applicable across all classes, whether it's a laser or a 420, 470 or anything. But these days there's footage out there that you can watch and you can just start to understand how people are doing the specific manoeuvres and then start to think about how you're going to tackle it yourself.
Yeah, that's great. That YouTube really does open up the world in a way that didn't exist 40 years ago, Hamish, when you were practicing your wire-to-wire tacking and then you sprang it on the world at your first World Championships in Quiberon. And how much has the world changed in terms of our access to knowledge now compared with then?
Yeah, well, it's immense. You know, you can, it's not much you can't find online. And if you can't find it, it's like we've always said in Road to Gold, you know, you can always go ask it. And I think that's something that we, you know, we really encourage. And I think there's not many people that won't give you an honest answer. So if there's something that's missing and something you'd like to know, very often you just, you know, just write the email to that person and say, well, how are you doing this? You know, what's the trick here? If there's something that's not quite, you're not quite sure about, and you, I reckon 99% of the time you're going to get an honest answer as well. Particularly when you're a young guy, you know, new to the class, a girl or guy, you know, coming through, that those people really want to see, they want to be challenged and they want to help the people at the top of the fleet. So don't be afraid to ask.
And Chris, you mentioned earlier about the things that you thought that you could do well in the 49er are just bog standard now, and the level has gone on to way beyond what you and Simon were executing 10 or 15 years ago in the fleet. So where is boat handling excellence going next? What is there left to do?
Yeah, well, I think that you know, we, I guess the best way to put it into an analogy, Andy, would be that we were able to sail the boat very well in a straight line and do good manoeuvres. But now I think the guys are able to sail with absolute tactical autonomy while sailing the boat in that straight line speed and doing the very good manoeuvres. So I think that, you know, we had to make a choice whether at each moment whether you'd slightly compromise your boat speed to look around and see what you're doing, or slightly compromise your manoeuvring if you're thinking about a tactical decision that you were making at that time. I think now, as the guys are getting better and better, they're able to execute those manoeuvres excellently while under pressure, on demand, whenever they want, without having to take brief moments of preparation to make it happen. And I think that's where it gets better and better, and is a very good measure of whether your boat handling is getting better and better, is, are you able to do it on demand, and can you execute it perfectly on demand? And while you might be able to do it in your own time, on your own sort of regime, you need to be able to do it excellently on demand when the pressure hits at that moment, you know, and when you need that tack to cross. It's not, we've got to do a good tack here. It's just a normal tack because we do very good tacks all the time, kind of thing. And I think that that is where the 49er has gone, and that's where it is in all of those classes that are elite level these days. I think the level is rising in all the sport across all classes.
And there wasn't much physical courage required to sail the most high performance of boats 20 or 30 years ago. The 49er was a step change. And now you look at what you've been sailing since the 49er, I doubt you'd ever be scared on a 49er again. So tell us about where you, I mean, maybe you already had that innate physical courage, but some people in the professional scene operating at the highest level must have had to have learn to gain this physical courage for the speeds that you're doing and the risk to life and limb that we see now. So how have you dealt with that?
I think when I was sailing dinghies, I think when in my day in the 49er, I think the 49er helm was regarded as, you could be pretty lazy, and the crew was the guy that worked very hard. And I think these days you can't get away with out being very fit in any of the roles on any of the boats. In the boats that I'm sailing more these days, it's a lot more mentally challenging, and actually fatigue comes from concentration a lot more from actual physical exercise. So I do a lot more aerobic stuff these days, and you know, the boats I'm no spring chicken anymore, and I'm like desperately hanging on by the skin of my teeth to stay on the boats that I'm sailing, you know. So I have to work probably a lot harder than I ever have done to maintain those roles. But certainly the biggest thing that I've learned over time is that to be able to stay mentally focused throughout a whole championship requires much higher physical fitness than I think people give it justification. I definitely realized that over time.
Yeah, which is obviously going to affect your boat handling as the championship wears on if you're not fit enough for it. Chris, we've covered a lot of ground. You've answered it beautifully. Hamish, any summarizing thoughts from you before we let Chris go?
No, I think Chris was some magical insights. Really appreciated the thought process that was coming through, and understanding how you go about getting better at boat handling, getting better at the sport, was really appreciated, and it's really great to touch base again. So let's make sure it's not this gap next time before we're having dinner again.
Yeah, thanks very much, guys. It's been fantastic, and it's really cool to see what Road to Gold is doing, and I think it's so applicable across all avenues of the sport. The sport's so broad and so exciting, and it's great to learn and get better at it, and it's very easy to just go along at the same level, and I think this is a great opportunity to take your sailing to another level, and thanks very much, Hamish, and Andy, for having me come along for the evening. It's really nice.
Thanks, Chris. You are an absolute gentleman, and that's just been reminded to us by Emma Craig, who says you're also a very nice Oppie parent. And I see Sarah Jane is one of many that's saying thank you at the end. So thank you, Sarah Jane, for digging out the YouTube video, which we're all going to go and look at now. Chris, it's been an absolute sport. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to catch up with you again. And we have learned so much about boat handling this evening. So we say goodbye to Chris. We say goodbye to all of you, but only for a week or so, because next week we are back with Chapter 4. And for that, we have the America's Cup legend, Chris Dixon. So we look forward to seeing you with another Chris next week. But for me and Hamish, and from the Road to Gold team, have a great evening, morning, wherever you are, and we'll see you in a week's time. Bye for now.